great deal of honor I have to introduce our speaker tonight. Our speaker is Phil Curtis, a past president of the Atlanta chapter of the Sons of the American Revolution, who is bringing us a special presentation on the Medal of Honor from Antietam to Afghanistan. Phil's background is in law, commercial real estate development, and executive search, where he is a partner in the firm of Onstead, Reed, and Couch. He also teaches courses in real estate and leadership at Georgia State, and is a member of the honorary real estate board, a former distinguished military student in ROTC at Harvard University, and first lieutenant in the Army Reserves. He has had a lifelong interest in the military. He is a past vice commander of the Military Order of World Wars, a colonel and past commander in the Old Guard of Gates City Guard, and a past president of the Memorial Day Association in Georgia. Military service runs deep in Phil's family, as his father was a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy and served in World War II. His great-grandfather was a captain in the Confederacy, serving in combat from Antietam to Appomattox, and he is a descendant of William the Conqueror. Phil is a graduate of Dartmouth College, Harvard Law School, and Harvard Business School, and with his wife Jan, an associate broker with Panhandle Realtors. He lives in Buckhead since 1974. Let's welcome Phil.
Turnout. I appreciate being here. You know, I was thinking coming in a room much like this in 1921, the first Sons of the American Revolution meeting took place, and that chapter, in fact, was the Atlanta chapter, joined in 1992. And the interesting thing is, in 1921, of course, I don't think many of us were here in 1921. Is anybody here in 1921? But if we were, that was the only chapter in Georgia, much less Atlanta. That was it. And we see, of course, it spawned so many. In fact, the chapter, the Atlanta chapter, was instrumental in helping form a number of chapters in Atlanta area. So I'm glad to be here. I will say, when I look at that, I was reminded that who was here last month, it was pretty tough to follow the President General. Larry Guzzi, who, as a matter of fact, in the early 90s, I could tell one day was going places. This guy was very sharp. As I told Jim, very knowledgeable, very conscientious, a hard worker. And he's grown below 25, 26. He's got the top job. So, well, let's see what we got tonight on this Medal of Honor today. Give you some just sense of how this started. I mean, this was not a lifelong objective to give this talk, but it sort of got cobbled together about a year ago, maybe a little less. But the inception of this was this guy right here on the left. And that's Nick Snyder. Some of you may know Nick Snyder, know of him. For many years, Nick was president or executive director of the military, what was called the National Museum of Patriotism, which is on Spring Street. Now, this picture was taken at the 2007 Memorial Day Association gathering at Burial National Cemetery. That was one of the years I was president. He's with the Tuskegee Airmen there. He made his way up to the dais, great difficulty, great guy. So Nick, turn to that next slide. There's that National Museum of Patriotism, which had a kind of a short run. If this were a Broadway hit, it wouldn't have lasted too many months. And one wonders why. It had some impetus, there was some decent backing, certainly great enthusiasm with Nick, but it just sort of petered out. I think what really kind of was his demise. He moved this from Spring Street, 10,000 square feet, and moved it over to where the Coke exhibit is, and the aquarium and all that. And he just sort of got outgunned. It was just too expensive. The move was disabling for him from a strategic standpoint. And he went out of business, if you will, in 2010. Next slide. Well, and that gives you some sense of how that looked when it was going well. Next one. Well, what happened? And this is emblematic of this. In 2007, about the time that the museum petered out, I get a call from Nick, because I met him at that Marietta event, which some of you maybe may attend from time to time. great event in and of itself. Well, I meet Nick, we get a call, I said, look, we've got a gathering downtown, one of the downtown hotels, the Medal of Honor recipients. Now, it wasn't this gathering, this was a much smaller aggregation. From time to time, you gather these folks. You see, those Medal of Honor recipients, they don't call them or awardees, they're not winners. They're very careful not to distinguish themselves. They really didn't win anything, but they certainly merited great commendation. So there, if you count, we've got, six, two of them in wheelchairs. This was after the 2007 event, which had, as it turned out, 35 or 36 Medal of Honor recipients. And one of the largest turnouts I've ever had on the gathering. Next one. So what happened there, it sort of gave me some impetus here, is I'd always had some interest, very little interest in the military, and somehow or other, I ended up buying this book. So I hear about this gathering. I take the book downtown. And by the way, one of the features was the great song that reminded me of Glad to Be an American. Who was that? Lee Greenwood. You can imagine the tears when he sang that song live and in person. These 35 Medal of Honor recipients stood up to be recognized. So I had the book. Now, after that gathering, you had a little time to go around and meet these guys. They were seated in one of their tables, very relaxed setting. And I had the book, so I got what I ended up doing was getting 35 autographs of these guys. And interestingly, the book had 116 were mentioned in here. Others may have been alive at the time. The book was actually published in 2000 and in the glass, I think about the same time, 2005, I think it was, 2 years earlier. Some of these fellows that weren't pictured in there, and we'll get into this later how this all works, but you see, each one would have a current picture. Here's the case where I got an autograph from a guy named Patrick Gregory. Well, some weren't pictured, but they were kind enough to autograph it anyhow. So here we got the book, we got 35. And I sort of put it aside. I read through these write-ups, and we're going to see some of those in a moment. I never kind of forgot about it, but I had the book in my office, and one day I thought, look, I've got 35. There's 79 living today. 79, fewer than what we have in the USN. I said, look, maybe I missed a few. So I went back to the book, and actually it wasn't as systematic as I might have done, because some of these fellows I reached out to had died. Now, you're not going to get that on there. But I went out, I went through a Medal of Honor Association in Washington, D.C., that sort of filters these requests. And over a period of time, I got about 15 more. So now, what I did, I took those autograph pictures and pasted them where they were in the book. So after the presentation, after the meeting, you're welcome to come up and see how this all got put together. So I've got about 48 or 49, only 79 living. I don't know who's got more autographs. But I finally figured I'll stop there. So anyhow, next slide. I'll give you a little historic context on this thing. The first light medal for commendation that we're aware of was created by George Washington, our own SAR, colleague, so to speak, in 1782. And you can see here kind of a depiction of that award. The interesting thing here, as best we can tell, there are only three or four of these ever issued, ever handed out. Three or four. And you can see it was 1782, so by that time most of the war, most of the fighting had taken place. And this is what George Washington had to say about that award. He talked about whenever a singularly meritorious action is performed, the author of it, and that's sort of colonial type language, shall be permitted to wear the figure of a Hardenberg clock. And the other interesting thing was, this was the only award that we had during colonial times. And one of the, and basically the only one until the Civil War of any repute. Now, if that looks familiar, you can see it's reminiscent of what was awarded and established in 1932, the Purple Heart. And no doubt they use that early award at St. Louis. Since then, sadly, in a sense, we've had 2 million awarded for injury and most of those, of course, World War II. Next one. And when you look at this Medal of Honor that we're going to talk about, you can can see in this write-up, this depiction, it is the highest military decoration today. Now, today we've got a lot more than what George Washington had at his disposal. Those are all military medals. Next one. What I learned is that there's not just one Medal of Honor, but there are three versions, an Army, Navy, Air Force was the most recent. It dates back to the mid-60s, and the Army and Navy are 1960s on the Air Force. But we had no Air Force in the 1960s. It's the only ribbon in the United States, the only medal suspended by a ribbon from the neck. You won't see a bronze medal or any other depicted that way. Next one. So what does it take to qualify for this Medal of Honor? We think it's the highest and most prestigious personal military decoration. The key is that act of valor. Somewhat subjective thing. We're going to see some real-life examples in a moment. But they distinguish themselves by acts of valor. It's the oldest continuously issued combat decoration because, in fact, it was originated in the Civil War. And up until that time, there were no other medals decorations. And it's illegal to wear somebody else's medal. It is illegal. And there was a period of time when it was illegal to wear a medal as a facsimile, to pretend, in effect, you were a Medal of Honor recipient. Not somebody else's medal, you just sort of get one manufactured. President Obama, at the time, sort of loosened that restriction up and said, well, that's okay, no problem. I think that's the way it stands today. George Bush tried to tighten that up, by the way. So it's prerequisite of an act of valor. Got to tighten that up a little bit. It's conspicuous gallantry, intrepidity. That's a world-class word there, right there. At the risk of life above and beyond the call of duty. I think we can all kind of relate to that. But it has to be action in actual combat. So you can't be in a back room at a desk in a rear echelon and obtain this award. And also has to involve an opposing armed force. So that narrows it down. And I don't know, certainly Afghanistan we see opposing armed forces. We see in a lot of instances. Vietnam, clearly an example. Korea, we're going to see examples of some of those. But there has to be an opposing armed force. Excellent. So you find that if, in fact, you do receive this award, there are a couple of things, several things go along with it. Your children, if you have any, are eligible to attend West Point, the Air Force Academy, Annapolis, without obtaining the requisite nominations or meet some kind of quota requirement. I don't think it means that they're automatically entered as a point of fact, but a number of the entrance requirements are lessened. If they weren't previously eligible for burial in Arlington National Cemetery, they are now. And then finally, you get this special flag. This was something that was introduced in the 60s, special flag goes along with it, which, by the way, is emblematic of the 13th original colonies. Next one. So what's the history? I mentioned the Civil War. And the other thing that becomes evident here is that no veteran ever received the Medal of Honor, despite the fact there were some 300,000 lost in that conflict. Many others injured. I'm not going to relive the war of the conflict and aggression, so to speak. But the reason the Confederate didn't receive one is because it was a Union award. It's a Union medal. And it was not applied to the Confederate. Now, as I said, it was established in 1862. Since then, there have been 3,515. That number is probably a little off by one or two at this point. 3,500 awarded, less than half, just a little less than half awarded for actions during the 4 years of the Civil War. And the reason for that is it was the only medal they had. You didn't have a Bronze Star, a Silver Star, Distinguished Service Medal, a variety of things. So if Lincoln and his generals felt someone was eligible for the award, that's the only award they had to give. And in a sense, it seems like it's a little watered down, but that's just the way it is. Now, since then, I can tell you that requirements have got a lot stricter. So the first ones were 19 of which went to the great train robbers, which, as you recall, was that great escapade where the northern echelon came down. 20 of them involved one way or another. And commandeered the general. Is that right? The general. Right down here in downtown Atlanta. Jumped on the
The Big Sandy, Kennesaw.
Oh, okay, Big Sandy. Well, I got a bunch of downtown. Good point. And the interesting thing is, they were on the train, sort of, and by the way, a key thing is that they were in civilian clothing. These are northern soldiers, by and large, in civilian clothing. And the locomotive conductor was having lunch, I guess, in Kennesaw. We know Kennesaw is where this ends up.
Big Sandy.
At the museum up there. And he's going to lunch. Next thing you know, he looks out the window, and his train's moving up the pipe, the locomotive. And they started to run after it, which they did with some success, but couldn't do much running. Then they got this little, these little pumper things that take you up the tracks. So it was a kind of a Keystone Cops thing. The thing's moving on up there with the Union, half dozen guys, a dozen or so in there. And finally, corralled up around Dalton. And they did it with the other locomotive, which was the Texas, and went backwards. They got another one out, got on the right tracks, and moved it up backwards to serve a bizarre thing. All right, next slide. Now, what happened of that 19, and I don't have the exact number, but roughly, I think it was 8 were hanged within about a month of this undertaking, primarily because they were viewed as spies, because they were in civilian clothing. Same type of thing happened in Taffin, of course, in the Battle of the Bulge, when the German forces, about 200 of which, got into stolen American uniforms during that conflict. They were changing signs. They knew English very well, and they basically held themselves out as U.S. Soldiers. When they were found out, most of those were hanged or shot, spies. Well, this sign is now, this is located in downtown, near downtown Atlanta, a few blocks from downtown. This is where James Andrews, who was the mastermind, the Union mastermind of this plot, let's say, who was not a soldier. And he had no grounds, whether he was civilian clothes or not. He was hanged at this location within several days of this event. And the interesting thing about this sign does talk about the story. You see the final line says, First Awards and Congressional Medal of Honor. And that Congressional Medal of Honor is another misnomer. It's called the Medal of Honor now for maybe the survivors. And Andrews, they say, was hanged there on a tree. That tree was there for about 40, 50 years until a building was built on that site. They took the tree down, brought it inside as kind of a memento. It was inside that building that still resides at that corner to this day. The building's about 120 years old. After 40 years, the termites have gotten to it. So they kind of had a little momentum. Or keep saying, next one. So how do these awards shake out? If you look at different battles, different numbers, of course, would apply. I did a little math on this, and what it turns out, almost uniformly, whatever the conflict, the fewer involved, the fewer the medals. But it seems to sort out about one medal for every 35,000 participants. And what that number adds up to, it's about seven, you're about 7 or 8 times more likely to slip on the bathtub in your home, or your shower, and kill yourself than it is to win one of these awards. Not that I would urge that either. But these numbers, it's an astronomical kind. And the other thing that's interesting about this, when you think about it, if you were to say a famous tennis player or a, let's say, Tiger Woods, so many of these fellows that we hold in high regard in their sport or in their walk of life have compiled a career of success and accomplishment. I mean, they know along the way they're building a record that's going to get them probably into a Hall of Fame somewhere, Georgia, or national or international. And that's good. But these guys who get this Medal of Honor, which is the highest award in the military imaginable, did not go out that morning or that afternoon with the idea, by golly, I'm going to obtain one of these Medal of Honors. It's a serendipity how it happens. It's just sort of accidental. I would say they're in the right place at the right time, but it might have been the wrong place at the right time. When you see these numbers, Somalia, 2. Probably get 2. That was the numbers were a little better on the average there. But the 16.1 million, World War II, only 500 managed to be awarded this medal. All right, next one. So what happened, this is after World War II, there was a rethinking of this thing. Now, wait a minute. Particularly with the Civil War. And there was a commission established by U.S. Congress to look at these, particularly these old-time medals, and feeling that some of them may not have been, they may not have really merited the award. They were done too cheaply in the haste. And an example of this was, and by the way, ultimately there were 600 identified like that. Remember, there were about 1,600 in the Civil War. And this commission felt, wait, 600 out of those were not worthy of merit. Some of those were the details on Lincoln's funeral burial. 29 members, they felt they wanted to defrock that medal. They were just standing around. They were guarding the course. I mean, it was honorary duty and perhaps exemplary to some extent, but not worthy of his medal of honor. But the interesting thing was they had the 600. They go through all this process, typical maybe of U.S. Congress. We identified the 600, but nobody literally had to return the medal. They kept the medals. And who knows what that is. I'm not even sure their families at that point. They lost the honor. All right, next one. The non-combat thing is what they're worried about. Now, here's 10 things. Now, this is a very knowledgeable group. So some of these things you may know. I'm going to throw them up there and see what you think. Let's take a look at these. 10 things you didn't know about the medal. Next. It's customary for the commander-in-chief to do the honors. Not always. If it's in a combat situation, president may not be in the theater, probably isn't. In your case, where you have the highest ranking officer, maybe a general, someone that would award the thing. And so often would happen, if it was the president, they'd send it back to the United States, the award would be made here, and oftentimes they were sort of sequestered at that point. They did not want to send these guys back into combat because of the PR, merit of all that. They wanted to get some recognition and the PR. Sort of thing. They would give talks if they would be presented around the country. But usually the president does. Next one. No statute of limitations. It wasn't too long ago, this guy, first lieutenant, Alonzo Cushing, they re-looked his situation, felt he was a worthy candidate, and the award was given. Not that it was in his name, and of course it was his descendants that really merited, really profited or that profit. Benefited from this award. 151 years until we get that right. So maybe we got ancestors in this room. Not this room, maybe we got the descendants of the ancestors. Looking back, maybe we can take a shot at this in hindsight. Next one. The youngest recipient was this Willie Johnson drummer, 11 years old, 11th Vermont Infantry. That's the youngest recipient. I had a drummer in 1812. Maybe we ought to go back and rethink that. Next one. I'm the oldest recipient, and I always get, I've given this talk a few times, and there's always a groan on MacArthur because of the Philippines. And I've read a lot about MacArthur, and I think this could be viewed as a political award. The U.S. was in serious trouble. The Japanese had overrun the Philippines, and certainly someone of his stature receiving this award. Now in Australia, may have buoyed spirits on the home front. But be it as it may, MacArthur did expose himself to fire. He wasn't entirely, it was caged over there, on Corregidor. But he was the oldest, 62 years old. He had the best looking sunglasses, I'll tell you that. Only woman. We get all these women here, and we're grateful to have the women. The only one who received the Medal of Honor out of 3,515 was this woman here, a Union Army surgeon in the field. You can see the award right there. Looked a little different on stage. Next one. The only recipient to have his medal inscribed to another person was this fellow right here to his mother. And you got to like that. So each medal is individually, not crafted, but it's inscribed on the back. Next one. Thomas Custer, George Armstrong, Custer's brother, one of 19 to receive two medals of honor. Of course, again, it's the Civil War. They're a little less restrictive on how they're doing it. That's pretty darn good to do, too. Next one. First African American received one. This gentleman here in 1863. The only father-son recipients of the Medal of Honor are Arthur MacArthur, Civil War, and I'm not sure it was the instance, but there was one very famous battle in the Civil War where Arthur MacArthur had a Wisconsin regiment. He was at the time, I think, at the moment, maybe a captain. And he urged these people to take this hill. It was a very strategic thing. And he used that expression, "Go you Wolverines." And this has become almost a battle cry for the University of Michigan. So not only get the Medal of Honor maybe out of that, but he spawned the university's battle cry.
That was Lookout Mountain.
It was Lookout Mountain. That's exactly what it was. Go you Wolverines. Good looking guy. That's a pretty tough act to follow. MacArthur, by the way, I believe, was first in class at West Point. You remember his mother took up a room in a hotel, or maybe in a home, right near West Point. So she could see the lights in his room. I wonder if the lights are still on. He's still studying. And then you've got Theodore Roosevelt. Now, the interesting thing there, that was for the Battle of San Juan Hill, primarily, and his exploits there. But he didn't receive this award until after he was president. Isn't that something? So we've seen that delay, that statue. And here's his son, Theodore Roosevelt Jr., who was a general in World War II and sadly died in roughly 1943 in Europe. All right, next one. And then this is sort of another footnote to Theodore, the only person to ever receive both the Nobel Peace Prize and the Congressional Medal of Honor, the two highest nationally recognized honors for war and peace. That's pretty darn good. Next one. We have five brothers that received the medal. Five brothers. I remember that instance, and this is not related to the Medal of Honor, but in World War II, was it five sons were killed in the same ship? Maybe it may have been.
It was a ship.
And they later changed that to, I think, only two could be on the same. So
what did Sullivan
say?
Sullivan. Approach. Very sad. Can you imagine having to go to Mrs. Sullivan and explain that to her what had happened? Next one. Now, we go to a couple of highlights here. We've got the World War I Potion Boy, Sergeant Alvin York. He's from Tennessee. The next slide. He's a Medal of Honor winner. He goes to Camp Gordon, now Fort Gordon. I spent some time in Fort Gordon. It was a Signal Corps. Now, I didn't have this kind of accomplishment. He is hitting perfect. This was not the kind of weapons we've got now. These are big old, these are all heavy, wooden, used for a squirrel hunting system. He's hitting perfect bullseyes with open sights more often than snipers do. So the guy can shoot. He goes to northern France, and you see this phrase, face of withering machine gun fire. Anytime you see that phrase, withering machine gun fire, you know you got a shot at this medal, so to speak. But all machine gun fire is withered. You ever see non-withering machine gun fire? So he single-handedly shot five Germans with his own rifle. He's out of ammunition, kills eight more with his 45, and then when they charge the bayonets. So he killed 28 that day, Alvin York. Next one. He receives the Medal of Honor. This was a rendition of this literally 20 years, over 20 years later. Actually, 22 years later, a well-known, well-received movie played by Gary Cooper, Roll Wilder. York came out of a contingent up in Tennessee, kind of a little well-known aggregation up there. Next one. And then on the flip side, or the like example in World War II, Audie Murphy. Well, that's kind of an example because you've got... You've got York being enlisted. Now we do have an officer here, but I tell you, I don't think he was an officer when this action took place. So here's Murphy. That's a pretty impressive thing. Next one. Here's his medals. Apparently, it's only a sample of his medals. There's still others. This is what he got. How did he do it? How did this guy get this kind of recognition? Next one. He was 5'5" and 150 pounds, which, by the way, in World War II, that wasn't a tall man, but that was pretty close to average, wasn't it? What's your early 45, this is actually 3 months before the end of the European conflict. What do we call it?
VE Day.
VE Day. VE Day.
So if this had been 3 months later, we never would have heard of Ollie Murphy. His unit, you can see this is in the Western Front in France. He's outnumbered 19 to 128 when he orders an attack. Now that was maybe a somewhat suspect maneuver right there. Surrounded by Germans, he gets aboard a burning, I always thought it was a tank, but it's a burning tank destroyer. He used a 50 caliber machine gun to push the enemy back, killing an estimated 50 combatants until he could organize a counterattack. Not a bad day at the office. Next slide. And this picture, this is Ollie Murphy 10 years later reenacting this episode for the Hell and Back, probably the first book I ever read, certainly a military book, 1955. And the interesting thing about Murphy, here he looks like a choir boy, doesn't he? Now, so here he's probably in his mid-30s, early mid-30s, maybe early 30s. He went on to do about 100 movies, a lot of westerns. Next one. So in a sense, the more charismatic of these Medal of Honor recipients sometimes did parlay this into a legitimate career, you know, a lot of notoriety. Here's seven first-hand case studies that were hopefully pretty quick. These are all in the book, and all of which I got the autographs. All right, next one. Oh, wait a minute. This doesn't work right. This slide, there's no Medal of Honor. Does that guy look familiar?
Yeah.
Now, that's not a beer. I wish that was a Coca-Cola.
Now,
there's my only medal. That's a service medal. I did get that. It was actually produced in the Vietnam era. It's sort of like an economic throwaway. You get it in a Wheaties box or something. As long as you're in the, and I never went to Vietnam, I was in the reserves, and by the time my number was punched, so to speak, I was a second lieutenant. They were winding down. They didn't need any more second lieutenants in Vietnam, and I went into a reserve staff. But I was ready to serve, as you can see. And next one. Now I'm going to show you this. This is a kind of a fascinating interlude here. One of these guys, I think you can see his picture a little bit up here at the corner, but this is a Medal of Honor recipient. He's in the book. I asked for his autograph. So he writes back. He sees my picture. I sent my picture to kind of give me some cachet and legitimacy, you know, fellow warrior, fellow veteran. From the information in your letter, it appears you were a student at Harvard when I was in Vietnam. I must say that in my 30 years in the armed forces, I never met anyone that graduated from Harvard. And from your picture, I never saw anyone in uniform that had a hairstyle like that. In addition, I don't think there was any Medal of Honor recipient who graduated from Harvard and was on the Vietnam Wall. In other words, lost their life in Vietnam. I could be wrong about that. Yours, J.P. Fleming. Well, I was tempted to write back. You don't want to get in a debate with these. You're going to lose that. Right. So next slide. I did a little research, though. And here's the interesting thing. This is in a chapel at Harvard University, Harvard Men Enshrined on the Vietnam Wall. You see that list there? So the university did lose a few men in that conference. Sad. Now, I could have sent that to them, but, I remember. So the next one. Then I went further. The top 10 educational institutions for MOE recipients. Of course, West Point, U.S. Naval Academy would lead the Harvard number 3. Even Virginia Institute of Technology, that's not BMI. BMI number has 7. And that's, of course, remember Thomas Jackson, Stonewall Jackson. I don't think Stonewall ever got a Medal of Honor. Why? Because he was on the South. Probably deserved one. And then Dartmouth, that went undergraduate, for some I had 3. So, it's not bragging rights, but Fleming was a little bit wrong in his numbers there. All right, next one. So here's what we got. I've got a few from each of the major conflicts represented in that book. And here's one right here. What this shows you on the, in fact, I've got a point here. This, you can see a picture here. But the lower right is the way they looked essentially when he was in conflict. And you received the award. This is the way they looked in 2005, 12, 13 years ago, that book was published. All right, next one. So Maxwell, World War II, is the oldest current living Medal of Honor recipient, age 98, maybe 98, by the time I did this slide. And you see how, this is the most unlikely guy to receive an award like this. He's a wire communications man. I was in the Signal Corps. So he was you know, Maxwell was basically stringing wire and poles. Now, how's he going to win the Medal of Honor in that situation? Well, one night, the German platoon advances, as you can see here. He's got a 43, he has issued a 45 caliber pistol. The enemy grenade clears, the enemy throws a grenade over, fearing to injure the officers, he smothered it with his body. And this is a classic way, you know, where these awards often are commended. With this kind of
selfless act.
Selfless act. And again, it's got to come to the attention of somebody. When he comes to it, the shrapnel, part of his foot blown away and so on, and he's either receiving the award. Excellent. We got another World War II veteran, Herschel Williams, Marine Corporal. Again, here we get the enlisted, the second enlisted guy. Excellent. So, now this is an interesting kind of sequence. He's on Iwo Jima when this famous photograph is taken. It was a Pulitzer Prize photograph. There's some controversy has gone on with the saying, well, this is posed. It was not posed. There was a smaller flag that was put up there minutes before. Someone said, well, we need a larger flag. It went down to a ship that was in the harbor. At this point, the fighting was somewhat attenuated on Iwo Jima. I didn't say that way, I'll tell you. But anyhow, they got this picture. So he sees this thing. He sees this flag going up. Inspired, this is in the sense of the mistake he made. He straps on a flamethrower. He assaults a number of enemy pillboxes. You see a lot of this in these write-ups. The flame and satchel charges, sort of they're like plastic explosive bombs. They sling in there. They try to break up these heavily concrete emplacements. And sometimes they're cave-like situations. Despite the fact that 17 of the 279 men in this instance had hit the beach, had not been killed or wounded. So you see, this is he is one of the last of the Mohegans here. And as an aside, the life expectancy of a flamethrower on the battlefield of World War II was less than 10 minutes. So he outdid himself on that. Excellent. Now we shift to Korea. Dwayne Dewey, corporal. He's very unassuming. But I think what happens with these fellows, you sort of sense in time that their character builds almost. This is a life-changing experience when you receive this award. Excellent. So he's in Korea. He's leading a machine gun squad. And you can see near Panmunjom. We've all heard that, I guess. He's overrun. This is a phrase we heard time and again in 52. Overrun by battalion-sized Chinese force. This is not a situation you want to find yourself in. Grenade explodes at his feet. Bleeding heavily. Second grenade flops in there. He falls on it to protect the medic. The medic's supposed to protect him. He turned the table on. President Eisenhower presenting the medal said he must have had a body of steel. So a great credit to Mr. Dewey. Next one. Now here we're also in Korea. I think this is a Japanese descent corporal. Next. Now he's in the Nisei 442nd Regimental Combat Team. All Japanese. Now I'll tell you, there's no love lost between Japanese and Korea. We know that. So he's got a machine gun, was attacked. They're sold in North Korea. That's certainly the news now, isn't it? Korea. That we haven't gotten away from this situation. His machine gun jams. He charges the enemy, killing 12 with his bayonet. Imagine that. He was later taken prisoner by the communists for 28 months, but the United States military that deliberately did not reveal the fact he had actually won the medal, not won, but he had awarded the medal on. The fear that they would have just torn this guy up. They would have made an example. You think you're so brave? Try this. He gets out and finds he was the recipient of that. Next one. And then we get Foley, and now in Vietnam. And you see, so many of these, through reserve units and other duty, their rank improved or became more exalted. He certainly wasn't lieutenant general, which is a four-star general when this action took place. The next slide. He was an alumnus of West Point. He captained the 62-63 basketball team. Went to Airborne and Ranger School. Now, he's ambushed November 5, 1966. He picks up a heavy machine gun, drapes the ammunition belt over his shoulder, big guy, tall guy, fires from the waist, shakes Audie Murphy, single-handedly destroying three enemy gun emplacements. Net result, Medal of Honor. Thank you. Staff Sergeant, U.S. Army. By the way, when they send these things back, because they had my picture, they had my name, it's just hard to believe they were so humble that, and selfless, if you will. He writes on this picture, thank you for your service. My best, Drew Dix. Isn't that something? All right, next one. Now, this is sort of providential. He's born in West Point, New York. Right at the, if you will, right at the emplacement there, right at the West Point facility, academy. We move forward 2 years. He's in the wake of the Tet Offensive, which you may recall January 1988, to 68, which really was a turning point in the war, which was, you might say, won by the United States, but one wonders what anybody really won anything throughout this thing. But we did prevail. He fights through the night, and he cleared this city of Viet Cong, killing an estimated 200 in the process. And one of those numbers may have been inflated, so many were in those days. But Dix did kill 24, and that'll get you some recognition. Next one. And this is the last one we've got, and this is the guy I got to know personally. Because he came to the Marietta National Cemetery event on Memorial Day. He has a Medal of Honor, and he came in. He was, I think, at the time living in Alabama. Came over and gave a nice talk. Gave a very inspirational talk. And this is the kind of guy, by the way, if you got in a fight, this picture was taken 12 years ago. I'm sure the bright was taken. This is the guy you want to cover your back. Don't you? Now, he was a SEAL petty officer. Next slide. And here's what happened here. Now it's 1972, but by that time I was commissioned in the U.S. Army. I was a second lieutenant. I could well have been over at that point if they needed me. But what happened here, a five-man SEAL patrol was installed, let's say, really too far north. They put these guys into North Vietnam. Now that wasn't maybe a smart move. They tangled up on their navigation and their coordinates. And they got into this firefight. 50 enemy soldiers emerged, a handful of SEALs. Well, Thornton, in the process, it looked like his lieutenant had been killed, at the least badly wounded, probably killed. He goes back, as they finally were leaving off the beach, trying to get into the water. He returns, kills two of these Vietnamese captors of his lieutenant, and drags the lieutenant, lifeless body, seemingly, into the surf, inflates the life vest, lashes the lieutenant to his body, you can see here, along with a Vietnamese SEAL. He got two people strapped to him. And Thornton swims 2 hours out to sea until rescued by a boat, Shades of JFK, after PT-109. Now, the interesting thing, it's not mentioned here, the lieutenant that he saved in that action later became a Medal of Honor recipient himself. The only time one Medal of Honor recipient saved another. Isn't that something? Right. We're only a couple weeks away from National Medal of Honor Day, March 25th. You may see some celebration connected to that. Next one. And the final analysis, we talk about these medals. It's an impressive thing to think about and to talk about, to learn about. But how about this sacred record? God will not look you over for medals, degrees, or diplomas, or for scars. We all have that. We don't often receive medals for them. I just want to leave you that thought.
Bill, we thank you, and we just ran out of time.